I'm turning this evening to the book of Proverbs, chapter 18 and verse 13. Proverbs chapter 18, verse 13. He that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it is folly and shame unto him. And our subject is Proverbs on relationships. Now I've been seeking to explain in the past that the Proverbs from chapter 10 on, roughly, these miniature parables, are grouped under certain topics, themes or subjects. Sometimes a topic commands 6, 7, 8 verses, sometimes up to 13 or 14 verses. These do not very often coincide with chapter beginnings and endings, and you have to figure them out for yourself. But on the whole, it's not all that difficult to do so, and to discern and to see the subjects that are dealt with in a string of proverbs. Now and then, it's rather difficult to find where one subject begins and another ends, and you might change your mind a little in drawing the lines. But on the whole, it's not that difficult. And here in chapter 18, from verse 13 to verse 24, we have proverbs that most of them are on relationships. Well, let's say 8 out of 12 of them are pretty obviously about relationships within the fellowship of God's people, or God's family, God's house. And so we may assume that the 4 proverbs that do not obviously belong to this category are to be understood in the context of the whole. And that brings them to life. And you can see their particular application. In this group of proverbs, verse 13 is about relationships. He that answereth a matter before he heareth it. I'll explain that in due course. Verse 16, verse 17, verse 18, verse 19, verse 22, and verse 23 and 24. They're all fairly obviously about relationship matters, and the others will fit in to that subject area. So, if we're going to do 12, that's 12 headings. I can't be very profound on each of them. We've got to hurry, but we get a bird's eye view of one of the sections in Proverbs that deals with fellowship and relationships. There are others, at least 3 others, that deal with the same theme, but from without repetition and dealing with different aspects of the subject. But here is one of the runs of Proverbs giving counsel from God on relationships. And verse 13 then, he that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it is folly and shame unto him. You could interpret this outside the context of relationships, and many people have done, in which case this is what you'll make the proverb mean. A person who is opinionated, and this is true, I don't think it's the fundamental intention of the proverb, a person who's very opinionated and expresses himself or herself on matters that he doesn't really know about would be covered possibly by this proverb. He that answereth a matter, answers a question, expands on an issue, before he heareth it, learns about it, reads about it, knows about it, well, it's a folly, and the word translated folly literally means it's an act of silliness. And it's shameful, it ought to be embarrassing unto him, because he'll speak nonsense and foolish mistakes. But actually, I give this as an example, that is not the real intention of the proverb, though that would make perfect sense, because it's in the context of a string of proverbs talking about relationships. So in that context, it's obvious that it's about maybe an argument or a dispute, or someone's made a complaint against you, something of this kind. He that answereth the matter, an issue has been raised. You either have to judge it, discern whether it's true or false, or listen to it, but he that answereth the matter, before he heareth it, before you understand what it's all about, well, it's a folly, it's silly conduct. You become superficial, and it's shameful. You should embarrass yourself. You haven't grasped the matter, you haven't digested it, you haven't weighed it, you're giving your defense before you've really heard what the complaint is about. You can imagine, for instance, parents with children who may be impatient and not listen to the child, and therefore answer off a child's case on something, or complaint, or opinion, without really hearing it out. Well, the parent runs the risk of, in the eyes of the child, being unfair, or superficial, or never understanding. And so the parent is acting in a silly manner, and he's being measured by his child, and he's coming across as being inadequate. He's not listening. He's not giving a true response or assessment. Or it could be between believers, between adults. So the first heading, which I should have given you, is fellowship always listens. In the promotion of fellowship in relationships, we always listen. We aim to be careful people and fair people and hear a thing out before we form a response or a judgment, whether between adults or whether children. The language is actually very strong. It is folly and a shame unto him. What fools we may make of ourselves by being hasty and not taking things seriously. So there's a little warning, and that would be the first of the Proverbs, and it's really in the context of relationships. We have to be careful. And that brings me to the second, which is in verse 14, and it's this, it's quite different. My heading would be fellowship, or in relationships, Christian relationships. Fellowship knows how to rejoice. Look at the proverb. The spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity, but a wounded spirit, who can bear? Now this proverb turns up in another place, in chapter 15, for example, and verse 13. I won't turn to it now, but there it has a different sense, though it's more or less the same proverb. It fits its context, the topic, which is dealt with there. But here, this is the meaning. The spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity, his illness. What is meant by the spirit of a man? Well, it's the disposition of a man or woman, the attitude of a man or woman. You might say the will of a man or woman. Hopefully and happily, your spirit, your disposition, your will is strong enough to sustain adversity. So if you're very sick, then you have a will to live and to look on the best side and to go forward and to recover. And the spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity. So this is spirit in the sense of your whole disposition or outlook or will, your approach to life. But the other side of the proverb, if the spirit is wounded, damaged, injured, some would translate it crushed, but that may be a bit hard, a bit tough for the word. But a wounded spirit, who can bear? The sufferer can't bear himself. This is somebody now who is profoundly pessimistic. and cynical about everything, and even bitter, and it's become a habit. Everything in life, you see the bad side, the downside, the gloomy side, and you can't bear it yourself. You become a moaner, a complainer, a perpetual grumbler, and people around you can't bear it either. So this is all in the context of fellowship. It hardly promotes fellowship and relationships if somebody has got into a pessimistic spirit. If it's a man at home, well, it's a misery for his wife because he's forever down under a burden and so on. Or it might be the wife who's developed a very pessimistic spirit. And the wounded spirit needs to be healed and restored. And for Christian man or woman, we need to be as much looking at the benefits and the blessings that God has given as the difficulties. And we're robbing God of his praise and we're not noticing. And every Christian who's living prayerfully, no matter how many difficulties and grievous things, should have many things to give thanks to God for. So the Apostle Paul commands us by the Spirit to rejoice always. But this person, sadly, the Spirit has been wounded and everything is seen negatively, and then it becomes tainted with bitterness. So it's in the context of fellowship, though it doesn't seem to be in this particular verse. The spirit of a man will sustain his illness, his infirmity, but a wounded spirit, that's another matter. If your whole disposition becomes negative. I've known people who have had a very important ministry for the Lord in pointing out woes and troubles and difficulties. And they've neglected to also speak about good things and the doctrines of God and the blessings and the strongly positive things. And they've become bitter and negative. And every time you ever talked to them, it was always all negative. And ordinary Christian people too, who've succumbed to this. And it's very damaging to them, and it's damaging to fellowship. And they get to exaggerating, and they can't cope with it themselves. So whether we're talking about our family life, again, something that children notice, the gloomy, pessimistic, negative spirit, which is so hurtful and frustrating to the young, and so on, we've got to be careful. We're Christian people. We're constantly addressing many unfortunate things and wrong things and sad things and identifying things in our lives that need to be put right and things in the world that are way off track. But we have to be careful to balance that with gratitude to God and recognition of all that he has given and all that he has done. And it's vital to fellowship. Do you find yourself avoiding the wholly negative person and turning to speak to somebody else? See them at a distance. You know what's coming. Always the same. A grumble, a complaint, a negative. Of course, this is about fellowship too. So the fellowship knows how to rejoice. The spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity, but a wounded spirit who can bear? And then I come to the next verse, and we're going to hurry, and this is the third, and I'll give you this heading: fellowship is ever learning. The heart of the prudent, verse 15, getteth knowledge. The heart of the discerning getteth knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeketh knowledge. Notice the word heart in the first part and the ear in the second part. So the innermost person wants knowledge, and in practical terms, we make sure we do the listening and the hearing to acquire knowledge. for the promotion of fellowship and relationships, you do need to be always learning. And Christian people should be particularly good learners in every field. You should be learning all the time, even outside the spiritual realm, current affairs, what's going on. Don't let it just all sail by you. You need to be following life and events, and then, of course, spiritual things, doctrines, and experiences of the Lord's people in the Lord's work. Because if you're not, then you've got no conversation. You've got no material with which to interact with other people. You've become a dull person. The little motto, use it or lose it, applies to this. If the mind isn't engaged with the things around us, we are to be interesting people and able to interact. I don't say learning the kind of thing that a worldling may learn, who seems to have a head ever absorbing knowledge of meaningless entertainment, celebrities and their lives and all that sort of thing, and superficial and nonsensical material. But we're to be always learning. If you stand still, you're not an interesting person. You've nothing to contribute. You've nothing to say. So always be taking note. You won't overcrowd the brain. The brain is wonderfully elastic and can absorb an immense amount of material, and needs to. And if you stop absorbing, well, then you become dull. And we want to be, all of us, like those very elderly people you come across whose eye is always bright and whose minds are as sharp as razors and pick up everything. We want to stay. And fellowship needs this. The heart of the prudent getteth knowledge. Learning, of course, most of all, Christian things. And I mean learning, not just adding. Because speaking for myself, there's all sorts of things I'm constantly aware of that I know, but I know them very imperfectly. And then you read more, and you hear more, and you put into better shape the things you thought you knew. But there were aspects you didn't know, you didn't understand. You had a slightly misshapen view of it. So it's not just a matter of acquiring, it's a matter of improving the concepts you hold and what you understand. The heart of the prudent getteth knowledge, goes after it, pursues it, and the ear of the wise seeketh knowledge. Well, it is, you may never have thought of this, but it is vital for fellowship. It is vital for relationships, to be somebody who has something sensible and profound and worthwhile and engaging and helpful to talk about. So we're ever learning. And kids, you've got a book on the go? Always something stimulating, spiritual, and even broader in your reading. But let me come to verse 16, because I must hurry more. And this is the fourth heading. Fellowship prepares the way, I'll call it. Verse 16 may bother you at first sight. A man's gift maketh room for him and bringeth him before great men. This is one of the four verses that doesn't superficially seem to be about fellowship. But it is, in fact. What's this? Is it a bribe that I'm reading about in verse 16? Surely it can't be. Is it a bribe? Is it like chapter 17, verse 8, which could be seen as a commendation of a bribe? Some people have gone into this in great depth, and they'll tell us, oh, well, you see, the book of Proverbs, and come to that, the Pentateuch before it, is definitely against bribes if they're made in the context of justice. To bribe a judge, to bribe a witness, to give a gift, ostensibly, to somebody engaged in a judicial process, to get a favour. Now, yes, The Bible sees that as highly criminal and utterly wrong. But they argue to give a gift, just to get a favour, outside the context of a judicial process. There's no condemnation of that, they say. Here it is in the book of Proverbs. But this is not a commendation. This is an observation to make us think. And it's true. In the world, a man's gift maketh room for him, gives him access to important people, and bringeth him before great men. And he can get great advantages and trade with them and all the rest. It's not an approval, it's just an observation. You can see it working in the world, misused, a form of bribery so often. Now, just see how this affects your fellowship life. If you have goodwill and do something kind to somebody, well, that will make it much more likely that you'll have friendly fellowship with that person afterwards. It's the idea which is approved, not the act. So learn even from the dubious bribe. It works. It gets access. It introduces the givers to great people. And learn from that. So if you want to promote fellowship and deepen relationships, be helpful people, have goodwill. Fellowship prepares the way. This is an honourable expression of the gift, if you like. To always be available and ready to help out, do a favour. Notice when somebody has a need of assistance, and that's your opportunity, and that sows a bond and builds fellowship. So fellowship, it prepares the way. And if there is no goodwill like that, well, fellowship will be much harder. Do you see the sense? The observation is applied in a much more wholesome way to fellowship. A man's gift maketh room for him and bringeth him before great men. And then that brings us to a fifth heading. Fellowship, of course, is fair-minded. Verse 17. This builds on verse 13 a little. He that is first in his own cause, he speaks first to represent his case, seemeth just. And somebody says to you, oh, this person has done something terrible and has wronged me. This church member, this whatever it might be, and has put me at a disadvantage and hurt me and so on. This is what they did. Don't react by going, oh, that's awful, terrible. He must be an utter rogue. This is an awful situation. We always hear both sides. We always hear what the other has to say. The idea in verse 17, he that is first in his own cause seemeth just. Maybe what has happened is there's been some disturbance with his neighbour, and his neighbour has done something, and he's complaining about it. But what he's not telling you is that he pulled down the neighbour's hedge and moved the boundary of the property a few metres onto his neighbour's. So of course there was going to be some response or some reaction. But he didn't tell you that bit. He that is first in his own cause seemeth just, but his neighbour cometh and searcheth him. That is to say, he makes his statement, and it is a very searching statement, and it exposes what the first person actually did to provoke the reaction. So always we hear both sides. We've known of problems even among Christian people where somebody has made bitter complaints about a Christian worker in another place, And this has gone round and it's been believed and taken seriously. And people have got very hot under the collar and indignant and said that Christian worker should not be supported. I've known four or five cases like this across the years. But when you heard what that Christian worker had to say about it, the case was quite different. It was another story to tell. And in Christian fellowship, and this is about our relationships, we always must be fair. And remember, there are two sides, and hear them. That's an obvious principle, but this proverb deals with it. Then, something which is related is my sixth heading, and it's verse 18. The lot causeth contentions to cease. Fellowship is ready to honour arbitration. If there is a dispute between believers in the Lord, Christian people, and it cannot be resolved, well, because we're the Lord's and He comes first, we are ready to accept arbitration in any seemingly unsolvable dispute. Look at verse 18. The lot, the casting of a lot, was often adopted. It's not being advocated here. This is an observation. This is worldly parties. Finally, these warring factions are persuaded to allow the throwing of a lot to settle the matter. And they agree. And it works. Sounds amazing, but it works. And some great international negotiations are conducted on this principle. Only a few years ago, they seemed, at least for a few years, to solve all the problem in the Balkans by something which was very similar to the throwing of a lot. A decision was made by an independent party, and everybody had agreed to abide by it. And incredibly, it worked. But this is only an observation. The lot causeth contentions, arguments and brawlings, is the Hebrew, to cease, and parteth between the mighty, powerful contenders, tearing each other apart. And the lot separates them. In other words, it brings peace, and the fighting stops. Now for us, the meaning of this, in a fellowship context, is that, of course, for the peace of the Lord's house and for the sake of the Lord who we serve, we will accept an arbitration in an argument. The lot causeth contentions to cease and parteth between the mighty. And if the world accepts that, on a lot, uncertain as that is, then how much more will believers accept it from a fair-minded, impartial person settling the matter for them, and they agree to whatever that person says? So that's about fellowship. It's a principle. And then verse 19 brings us to another. Do you mind my racing through? Because otherwise we'd never have the opportunity to cover this marvellous set of counsels on fellowship. Well, it's the seventh heading, Fellowship Never Wounds. A brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city. What does that mean? Well, a person who was your friend and your brother, and you had obligations to each other as Christian people, and you're deeply offended by some wrong, and you've been repudiated by the other party in some way, well, that offended brother is harder to bring back than a strong city to be brought down. Yes, a strong defended city, you can lay siege to it, and in ancient times, most such sieges ended in about 3 months, and the problem was over. And in the worst case, in the Bible, a siege holds out for 3 years. But a dispute with an offended brother can last for 10 years or 20 years. It's harder to win somebody who's been known love and affection and is wronged and hurt. It's harder to win than it is to lay siege to a strong city. So the moral of the proverb is, don't offend in the first place, because the consequences are very hard to repair. Never, never, never say cruel or wounding things, or act in a cruel or wounding way within the fellowship of God's people. It's sinful, but the consequences are painful. So it's a solemn warning in that 19th verse. Fellowship never wounds, never insults, never ignore, never punish somebody with an act of rejection in this way. That's the meaning, because hurt is so hard to repair. And then that brings me back then to an eighth heading, and it's verse 20. And this, to me, is intriguing. Fellowship loves to edify. This is a rule for relationships. A man's belly, in other words, his innermost appetite and contentment, a man's belly should be satisfied with the fruit of his mouth. In other words, his words to others, his ministry of words, and every man and woman here has a ministry of words. The stewardship of words. We are all of us giving out words. It's a ministry, friends. And if we administer, marshal, utter those words in a right spirit, it's tremendously fulfilling to us. If you can give words of encouragement, it's fulfilling to you. A man's belly, innermost desires and appetites, should be satisfied with the proof, with the fruit of his mouth. If you've been useful, if you've been helpful, it is very uplifting to you to have an effective ministry of words. So it's invigorating. Why? This principle, I don't want to complicate matters, but it applies even in a wrong sense. And I don't commend it for this, but if a person is very angry and gets his anger off his chest, he feels better. Well, that's in the wrong sense, you see. On the other hand, don't forget that if you do good with words, and you're constructive and helpful and edifying, well, you get great personal contentment and satisfaction. And with the increase of his lips shall he be filled. You'll be invigorated. This is not about small talk and nonsense, but this is about contributing to one another in encouragement and helpfulness, expression of good things, in teaching where it's applicable, and so on. It's something which greatly increases our own fulfillment and well-being as a Christian man or woman. And it's so beneficial to fellowship. A man's belly should be satisfied with the fruit of his mouth. So think of your words as a ministry. Fellowship loves to edify, was my heading. Well, now it brings me to a ninth, and it's verse 21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. It kind of follows the previous. Fellowship watches its tongue. In this ministry of words, we're very, very careful to put a value on what we say. Am I about to say something which is hurtful, destructive, or positive, and honours the previous verse, is edifying? Death and life are in the power of the tongue. The illustration in the parable, of course, is that of a warlord or a powerful king whose very word can execute or spare people. But in a sense, every Christian is in the same position. Every word can help or hinder. Every word can hurt or assist. And we, if we can say, oh, when I speak to people, it never occurred to me. Well, that's a pity. We should be able to monitor the value of our words. I don't think I said much which was edifying today. Sometimes we'll say to ourselves, I think I got embroiled in something which can hardly do any good. We need to examine ourselves and help ourselves to speak things which are positive and constructive. But a tenth heading in verse 22, whoso findeth a wife findeth a good thing and obtaineth favour of the Lord. Well, let my heading be this. Fellowship leads to marriage. The most natural thing in the world is for somebody who's engaged in fellowship to find a wife, to find a husband. We may not care for the way in which this is rendered in our version. Whoso findeth a wife findeth a good thing. Well, you'll be pleased to know thing is not in the original. It's in italics. Findeth a good matter would be more tasteful, wouldn't it? Perhaps you can think of even better words. But thing is only to help us. It's not there. Whoso findeth a wife. Findeth actually doesn't here imply a search, though that may be necessary, but it doesn't imply a search. It's a Hebrew term which more means discovers. Whoso discovers a wife findeth a good matter, a lifelong companion and friend. Of course, this is written from the point of view of the man. It could equally well be written from the point of view of the woman. Whoso findeth a wife finds a treasure to value, a good matter. A mother in Israel, a storehouse of kindness and insight, a fellow labourer to share all your responsibilities, a loyal advisor and corrector, a servant of the Lord to be upheld. Whoso findeth a wife finds a helper in joy, a second conscience to go alongside your own. And I've found over the years that wives' consciences can very often be much more sensitive than those of their husbands. So that's a precious matter. A noble and honourable equal in the sight of God. And obtaineth favour, kindness and acceptance of the Lord. You have a reward from God for having a wife or a husband. Because to have a wife or a husband is the crowning expression of fellowship, which is the subject of this string of verses. And my 11th heading, because time is up really, is in verse 23. The poor useth entreaties, but the rich answereth roughly. It's an observation, and it relates to the general subject here of fellowship. A destitute person, a poor person, in that society didn't demand, but pleaded and asked humbly for help. But the rich answereth roughly. He's haughty. He denies this and denies that. He doesn't feel for the other party. And the reason we're told this, it's obvious. In fellowship, we are to ask and be more like the poor and the humble and respectfully ask each other for whatever is desired or needed and not be like the haughty rich who snap out their requests and so on. The poor useth entreaties. That's us as believers. To each other, we behave with honour and humility. But the rich, he's haughty. He thinks he's better. He looks down on the other. That's not us. That's not the standard for fellowship. So, fellowship is never haughty, I would say. And finally, the 12th heading, and it's the 24th verse, is this. I've called it, fellowship is choosy. In other words, to promote fellowship, we discriminate. I'll show you what I mean. A man that hath friends must show himself friendly, and there is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. If you don't mind, I'm going to give you an alternative reading, which seems to me to make much more sense. And it is the reading that was adopted in 1904 by the Revised Version. And it follows the observation which just about everybody now accepts, that in this verse there's a word that's been overlooked or misunderstood in the Hebrew. A man that hath friends must show himself friendly is better rendered, may be ruined by those friends. There's a Hebrew word there in the mix that actually means ruin. And very similar to a word which has to do with revealing or showing yourself. But I think it has been misunderstood. And that this final proverb, verse 24, should read something like this. It's literally a man of friends. That's the Hebrew. A man of friends. You see, it's obviously speaking about a person who has lots and lots of friends. He or she zooms about and knows no end of people in all sorts of places and rushes round after them. A man who, of friends, but he's evidently not a discriminating person. If he had somewhat fewer friends, but they were real friends, good friends, friends who shared his values and his standards, he's been much better off. But they're not people who share his standards and his values, and there are lots of them. And so the proverb should read, a man of friends is ruined by them, or may be ruined by them, because he becomes more like them, he's enticed by them, he's ruined in that he's always a lightweight. He's sold himself to so many people. He doesn't have any good friends. He's just got a whole raft of superficial people he hobnobs with or visits or whatever. A man of friends, they'll be his ruin. But, instead of an end, and here's the contrast, there is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. Better to have one than 100. One real friend, though the proverb isn't actually saying that's how you should solve the problem, it's putting it this way to make the point. Better to have one real friend than 100 shallow friends who don't share your values and will even be a bad influence upon you. And as Christian people, we're careful like that. We have worldly friends for their benefit, because we may be able to reach them. So we maintain cordial relationships with them. But they can't really be our friends with whom we share deeply. We have so little in common with them. But we're more selective when it comes to real friends, because depth of friendship is what is important with people who are like-minded. A man of friends may be ruined by them, but there is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. Can you be friendly? More friendly with someone who isn't a brother than someone who is a brother within the family after the flesh? Oh yes, easily. Because brothers at best may feel an obligation for each other, but they may also be rivals and grown up as such. Who knows? You can have a much closer friendship even than that of a blood brother in the Lord. We often apply these words to Christ, who is the supreme friend, and that's a wholesome and legitimate thing to do. But the proverb doesn't actually have that in mind. It says, make friendships, but not with any old person. So they're all superficial, and there's nothing that really counts. Nobody who will be loyal to you, nobody who will warn you when you go astray, and so on. So fellowship, I've called it, is choosy. Well, there are 12 headings. It's an overview of some of the counsel in Proverbs and some of the practical principles for fellowship and relationships. And there are other sections dealing with the same subject, but it gives us an insight also into how Proverbs work and how profound and how helpful they are. And I hope it's been of help to us this evening. Let's sing together our closing hymn. It's hymn number 6.